from the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, good morning. It is the Real World Money Day, the last day of May. Well, the last day, May 31st, 2017. Man, Tempest, whatever. What is it thing Andrew asked?
Tempest in a teacup?
Tempest in...
Or is it a teapot?
In a teapot. Tempest in a teapot. Mm. You haven't been taking pictures of President Trump's head burning, have you, over the
week? Oh, goodness.
Did you see that thing?
Yeah, I did. It was...
It was really weird.
Over the line, maybe?
Over the line. What we're talking about, there's this comedian. I don't think she's too funny anymore. I don't know if she ever was. She's
desperate to be relevant.
Kathy Griffin.
Yes.
Yeah, she did a whole ISIS gag thing with the president's head in blood cut and stuff like that. And nobody's
holding
really,
it up by its hair.
Nobody's happy. Nobody. Matter of fact, even
she apologized, okay.
She apologized, but even Chelsea Clinton said, You are scum of the earth. You are just... Even Chelsea said that. Well, you know, was protecting Donald Trump for that one. Well, Andrew Goss, it is the Real World of Money. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. I think there must be something, a big picture here that we can talk about other than politics with this this pushback against President Trump. Everything from, you know, every day. To explain to us kids, like we're golden retrievers in the cheap seat, for those of us who don't see the big picture when it comes to geopolitics, money, and what we talk about here, and what's going on with President Trump and day in, day out, this pummeling of just stuff that doesn't seem to end. And so far, there hasn't really been much substance to any of it. I haven't seen anything yet. I mean, maybe he's committed a crime, but I don't know.
Well, there is such a thing as a news cycle, Patrick. And, you know, the more they keep him engaged with fighting the news cycle, and the less time he has for his America First proposals. Just that simple.
So the globalists, the boys that don't want anything on trade or anything on banking or anything on
no, they want to dismantle Dodd-Frank. They don't want to build a wall. They don't want to kill our trade deals. They don't want to kill our climate pacts. They don't want to stop regulation. Yeah,
anything that the president's doing, the globalists, the people that own the media, correct? They just don't like it.
They're opposed. So, hence you get things like Kathy Griffith cutting off the president's head and holding it up covered in blood.
Isn't there a law against that?
No. In fact, you know, it just shows how far the left is willing to go to silence this message. You know, this is dangerous stuff. We're messing with the planet now. You start dismantling the climate change legislation.
Oh, man.
Oh, now you've touched their sacred cow, their worship of Mother Earth.
Before we move on, we'll get into your take on what the climate change thing is. But so really, you laid it out there pretty clearly. Pretty much anything that the president is for, that own the media, they're against, right?
They're against.
And then I guess we can conjecture that they own most of the, all the different Democrats, all the people in Congress, they're all in on the game too, right?
Yeah. The G's and the N's.
Wow.
Yeah, not the R's and the D's. That's so old school.
These are the
globalists and the nationalists.
The G's and the N's. This is where it's at, yeah. So who are the ends? Or the who are the ends? The ends aren't speaking up much.
A damn few of them. That's why.
You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
But are the people who voted for Donald Trump, they're half the country, right?
Yeah,
kind of, sort of.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a great many Americans believe, half the country, that America should be first. We should worry about taking care of ourselves before we worry about taking care of others. Sort of like you mentioned, the airline, you know, put your mask on and then help those around you. But get your mask on first. We don't have a mask, folks. We're not doing anything to take care of ourselves. And instead, we find ourselves, you know, around the world taking care of others.
But, you know, you still hear, I heard a little interview on an NPR yesterday. And this was a lady who did the NAFTA thing, and she was on there just telling people, "Wow, that's weird. You don't normally hear an airplane over here." Oh, it's a helicopter.
Oh, great.
Is it black?
Is it black?
Oh, yeah. It's pretty black. Is that a problem, Andrew?
It's black, and it has a satellite dish coming out of its side. Yeah, you might have a
they're
problem.
They're flying right over my house here, so it's... Oh, God. Where was I before the black helicopter came over? They're probably just checking tinfoil hats every morning. They check. Where was I going with this? Did you know where I was going? Oh, man.
No, but you were heading there pretty robustly.
I was robustly, but I wasn't even... I lost it now. Oh, man. Oh, well, what are you going to do? It was the NPR thing and the trade gal who did the NAFTA thing. And you know, over and over, they just keep saying that this NAFTA has really been a good thing for our country.
Right.
And, of course, the person interviewing, you know,
He
thought it was. So everybody thought it was. I mean, has it really been a good thing, NAFTA?
Well, if you would suggest lower prices are a good thing, I guess. You know, cheaper, certainly cheaper to make things in Mexico and bring them into the United States. But the rippling effect of that cheaper product is that your neighbor doesn't have a job, your Teamster brother-in-law doesn't have a truck driving job, and a great many of the manufacturing plants of this country have made their way south of the border, where they're enjoying full and robust employment. And additionally, all of the payroll taxes that those folks pay, they don't pay to the Treasury of the United States, they pay to the Mexican government. And so the Mexican government gets revenue to pass around their cronies, but we as a nation are deprived of the tax payments that those workers would otherwise make.
This lady on this interview yesterday, she said, well, one thing that the anti-free traders don't talk about is many of these imports that come in are then used to make products that then we sell back out again. Is that true?
Well, yes, of course. We assemble components, say the dashboard of an automobile in Mexico, and then we import the dashboard into the United States and plug it in a car. Maybe sell the car in Germany.
So that's not a bad idea. That's not bad. But... So is that a big component in our exports that we shouldn't be saying are not good? Like Mr. Trump's, he always does the trade imbalance. I mean,
I mention a $400 to $600 billion trade deficit?
That's a lot.
$54 billion with Mexico alone last year.
Uh-huh. And the trade deficit. How does
the difference between what we export and import.
Right. And how does that translate into hurting the United States?
Well, because, again, the Treasury is deprived of the revenue. If those jobs were in the United States and that payroll was in the United States, the amount of payroll tax that those folks would be paying would... really make a difference as far as the Treasury is concerned.
Yeah, that's a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot.
It's a lot.
And if you look at it again, just on the short picture, prices rather than prosperity. Prosperity would be booming if we imposed a tariff on imported goods. Because manufacturers would quickly realize, in order to overcome the tariff, we're going to manufacture domestically. and with it all of its jobs and all of that revenue for the Treasury and the states and even the municipal governments.
Is it a fair conjecture, though, to say that these jobs
are low paying?
Well, no. That these jobs,
they are in Mexico.
We could do all this stuff here, and that could be jobs. Is that too far of a stretch?
Yes.
Okay.
That's not too far of a stretch.
Oh, that's not too far of a stretch.
No.
Oh, okay.
I mean, 10.8%. I think of our total U.S. trade is Mexico. 10.8%. They're right behind China. 12%.
Yeah.
So, Canada's our biggest trading partner. The Canadians, eh?
Yeah. So now President Trump is going to get together with, I guess, Mexico. Well, his people are in a couple of months, and then they're going to rework this NAFTA thing.
And so we should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we export, aircraft, right? Aircraft parts, construction equipment, telecommunications equipment, that's it.
Uh-huh.
You know, the rest of the entire marketplace we've given away. And I'm not sure why. I just can't quite put my finger on it. I was like, why would we do this? We've totally disabled our heavy manufacturing base, our ability to produce raw components, as well as our ability to manufacture everything. I always bring up that little red wagon. You remember that?
Sure.
Little red flyer.
Oh, yeah. I had one of those guys.
Sure, stamped out of a piece of steel and, mm-hmm. you know, painted red.
Real deal, yeah.
Yeah, the real deal. And our ability to do that, of course. You know, injection molding is sort of taken over for steel stamping, and we tend to offsource that because it's a messy business. So everything is overseas. Nothing is domestically manufactured, except for, again, those main components, aircraft, automobile parts, and construction equipment, you know, Caterpillar, John Deere, so forth. That's why the Export-Import Bank exists, because the aircraft are so expensive that we have to finance them before we can sell them.
I think that helicopter is going to land here on the lawn. Maybe President Melania are coming over to for lunch.
Pick your brain.
What do you think? You
know? Maybe.
Yeah. I don't know, man. That's a weird noise. Would the right way to be to do it would be to have a tariff in and out for everything? In other words, if we sold Mexico something, then we should. I mean, would that?
And they want to charge us a tariff?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Would that be bilateral
trade deals? Yeah,
that's the way to do it.
That's the way it is right now.
That's right.
I can't export coins to Canada.
You can't?
I can't. There's a tax.
No.
There's a tariff.
Really?
So yeah. So I can't export rare coins to Canada.
Could you legally if you wanted to?
No, I can, but I would have to pay the tax, which kind of kills the investment prospect, doesn't it?
Oh, so Canadian people would be
taxed like 20%.
Oh, it's crazy.
It is, yeah.
Why would they buy from you then?
Why would they buy it from me? Precisely, but we have a free trade agreement with Canada, don't we? No, apparently we don't. It's only free as it relates to their products coming into the United States. I don't want to be so facetious, but the harsh reality is that if it were a free trade in both directions, no tariffs on anything, it might work. But it's not. It's a one-sided, like, horrible deal.
But
if we describe it as a bad trade deal, it's an accurate description.
Oh, you mean, so you think it's possible if you did totally open kimono, right? Just totally nothing. It's just like shipping
across all industries,
yeah,
shipping no
down the street, just right. Boom, boom, boom. But
yeah.
Then your arguments about China with no OSHA, no fooey, suey, mooey, no health care.
Or wholesome standards.
And
I
then,
mean,
and then the
their products are always adulterated,
yeah.
Always. It's like in
no
every
no standards
instance.
There, and then no... with the whole currency cattywampus thing,
sure.
That wouldn't be fair then, would it? I mean,
of course not.
No, you couldn't do it. You had to balance it out some way.
Yeah, and the only way to do it is individualized tariffs, mm-hmm. This idea of a one world, because everyone is different.
Yeah.
So, you know, you charge tariffs to a country like Germany on a different level than you would a place like China.
Yeah.
So Germany, for the most part, has worker safety programs in place, worker training programs. They take care of their people. Then lots of benefits, right? They don't use them like cattle. And environmentally, they're very sensitive to pollution and so forth. So there's a country that on which we can compete with a level playing field. You know, let the best man win, so to speak.
Yeah.
You throw into the mix, you know, poor safety standards and poor product wholesomeness standards. My goodness, anyone can compete with adulterated products.
Andrew Goss in the Real World of Money. Come on in and join us. 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at oneradionetwork.com. Speaking of Germany, so I'm gonna get a little history from you of why Germany has been on the leash of the United States for so long. But it seems like something's kind of breaking up with Mr. Trump. You know, he is a bull in a china shop. God love him. He gets over there with the G7 thing, and everybody was going to do a kumbaya over this Paris thing, right? Whatever, the climate change thing? Or
nope.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
what,
no, that was the theory.
That was the theory. And he goes, nah, you know, I don't know. I don't think.
Stick a fork in it.
I don't know. So now he says this morning, he tweets that he's going to make a decision on the Paris thing next week.
Nah, he's out.
I hope he is out, because I think that's, you know, the whole.
It's just another way to tie our hands behind our backs. That's, you know, simply put.
Really?
That's what it is. So a country like China is allowed to pollute to the environment at levels that are unheard of, while we in the United States are strictly regulated. And that gives them, again, a competitive advantage.
So the people that have put these things together are the boys, the globalists?
Yes. Yeah,
they're the people that have put these accords together.
Correct.
Because they don't really care about us.
And they don't care about the environment.
Of course not. They don't care about the environment. They don't care about the people.
It's the Hegelian dialectic is what it is. It's like, okay, well, hey, this problem, this mantra, we're killing the earth. Yes, we're killing the earth. We're going to kill ourselves and our children if we don't stop. Mm-hmm. That's enough reason. Why should we throttle back manufacturing? Why should we throttle back energy production and so forth? And that's the reason that we should. And so, you know, here's the problem, global warming. What's the solution? Choke down our industry. Okay, let's do that. It doesn't make any sense.
But then how did they benefit from that?
How do who benefit?
The boys, Doug and Mel.
Their factories that are producing without such regulation have a competitive advantage.
Oh, I see, because they own, they're over there.
Everything.
Everything. So they're over there in China doing their thing. And
yeah, how do you think the plants got to China, you know, or Indonesia or Bangladesh or wherever the heck they're building? You know, that's how they got there, free from regulation that hampers American companies.
Uh-huh. So they get in there and play golf and with their lobbyists and then get these things written.
Correct.
Right. And then everybody just goes for it because they control the message.
Correct.
In the media. They control the message. They control the message.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so every time they say climate change, it's
everyone's ears perk up. It's like Pavlov's reaction there, right?
They call it climate change now, which means that it's a done deal that the climate is changing.
Nothing we can do.
The people are responsible for it, and it's going to be really, really, really bad.
Expensive
and hard and kill things, and you're going to die. And that's pretty much it, isn't it?
That is it in a nutshell. Yeah.
And it's so interesting how they can control that message and so good at it. You know?
And let's not forget Al Gore's cap and tax credit exchange.
Yeah, that's on top of it. Right?
Yeah, on top of it. He, you know, of course, with partners, rushed to set up an exchange in Chicago that will sell and buy the ability to pollute, essentially. So, you know, here we have your carbon footprint, your measurement, and as an industry, you use too much, so you have to reduce it. And another industry uses too little or, you know, doesn't use their allocation. They're allowed to sell that excess, those carbon credits, to the companies that that need to buy them because it's cheaper than expanding. And, of course, in the middle of that transaction, Al Gore and his partners. So it's one thing to highlight a problem like this. It's quite another to profit from them. It's, you know, it's like me selling rare coins and using everything I know about money to justify the purchase of rare coins. Al Gore's doing exactly the same thing.
And the people, so many people just believe it, Andrew. Just, you know, they just believe it, that this is what's going on.
Sure.
They just believe it. You hear them repeat it all the time. Well, you know, we have climate change, you know.
Academia.
You know, wow.
I would point out that I did that study, I don't know, the Federal Reserve and PhD doctorate level economists.
Yeah.
They own them all.
Yeah.
Like, there's only a handful of doctorate level economists that don't either work for the Federal Reserve or take contracts from the Federal Reserve. So who's going to speak out against the guy that's writing your big paycheck? It's the same thing in academia. You know, these professors, these climatologists.
I'm a climatologist.
Yeah, for the most part, you know, you get up to the doctorate level, how many of them work for the EPA? How many of them work for agencies or entities that promote this line of thinking?
Uh-huh, yeah. And so you kind of know what the result of these papers and these studies are before, you know, you just know. That's just, it almost seems medieval. It almost seems like, I don't know, when you start arguing flat earth and round earth and science and religion 1,000 years ago, you know, and people make stuff. It's been the same way all the time. People are always making stuff up, aren't they?
Just to suit their needs.
It's really... really curious. It's the Real World of Money. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Join the show with it, will you? 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. So years ago, I guess after the war, Andrew, is that when it all happened?
Yes.
The United States...
the Marshall Plan.
The United States really didn't beat Hitler. Soviet Union did, pretty much.
That's right.
So by the time the United States got in the deal, Hitler was...
It was done.
It was a done deal. But somehow, I don't know how the United States then told the world or told Germany that we won and you lost. How did that work?
Well, because of the Supreme Allied Command
the Supreme Allied Command.
Yes.
That was Ike and the boys,
yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
So the Supreme Allied Command were... a bunch of generals and everybody say that we won? kind of thing?
Yeah, we control this. You remember Alexander Haig in the White House. I'm in charge here.
So the Supreme Allied Command,
yes,
they stepped up to the plate after the United States went in and cleaned things up.
Yeah, and Patton's, of course, saying, let's just keep going because we're not done yet.
Yeah.
Let's keep going. Let's go right into Russia.
Mm-hmm. So they went right into Russia.
Well, that's what Patton wanted to do, yeah. George Patton. But the cooperation that evolved from World War II left the Supreme, or NATO, if you will. That's essentially what happened after, right? So the Western powers with Russia excluded. And that's how Russia felt, like they were cut out of the process.
After they did all the heavy lifting with Hitler.
Sure, sure.
Wow. Yeah,
I think it was 3 out of 4 Germans that were killed in World War II were killed by Russian soldiers. German soldiers.
They don't tell the kids that in the history books.
No.
That's kind of left out.
That's not to take away from the bravery of the troops from other countries.
Yeah.
It's just to say that Russia was sort of cut out of the process.
Well, all the movies that are made, they're always about the United States. Yes. Hitler, right?
Yes.
It's not
Although Stalingrad, that was that good movie made about Stalingrad and the fight that
was
the
that
Russians,
a good one?
That's a great one.
Oh, it's called Stalingrad?
I believe that is the title.
I have to get that one.
Yeah. Oh, no, forgive me. It is entitled Enemy at the Gates.
Ooh, yeah.
Enemy at the Gates with Jude Law. And it shows you the Battle of Stalingrad in a nutshell. It's where the Russians sent their soldiers against the Germans. Like, one had a rifle,
uh-huh,
one had bullets.
Wow.
And whoever fell was supposed to grab the other guy's supplies and continue.
Oh, good.
It's like, you don't even get a gun. You just get some bullets. And you don't get a bullet, you get a gun. And, you know, between the two of you, we're hoping that these two things make it to the front so that you can actually fight. It was a brutal battle, and it was engaged in mostly by Russians on Russian soil.
Mm-hmm. We're going to do a quick little break here, and then we're going to talk more about this Germany thing and Merkel and the ties and the economic ties that have been with this country. And a lot of stuff on my plate this morning. If you care to join us and get in a question or a comment about your particular thing going on in your life, we're going to talk about housing, also mortgage rates, where they are. A lot of cool stuff. Patrick at oneradionetwork.com or 888-663-6386.
Dr. Otto Warburg won the Nobel Prize for discovering how cells breathe. He also discovered how normal cells turn into tumor cells. He discovered the one prime cause of cancer was cellular oxygen deficiency. Dr. Joanna Budwig built upon the work of Dr. Warburg and discovered how to feed the cells to overcome this oxygen deficiency. She found that it was the sulfur in the cottage cheese that when mixed with fresh pressed flax oil, that the flax oil would become emulsified and more readily absorbed. Flax oil delivered in this manner was able to restore oxygen transfer to all cells of the body. Now there's a new method of pressing seed oils that produces the highest quality, zero oxidation, undamaged seed oils. The results on these seed oils alone are amazing. Now add our Life Force Enhanced One World Whey Protein Powder that is much higher in the sulfur amino acids than cottage cheese is, and you have a winning combination to confer health and energy like never before. Click on the 5-seed oil banner right here on OneRadioNetwork.com. That's OneRadioNetwork.com.
I used two of these products this morning. Isn't that cool? The One World Whey and a little smoothie I had. And then also the flax oil. And then the colostrum is what I put in, and some cherries. Put that little baby in the Nutribullet. Zipped it up, and oh, man, it was really, really yum. Well, I also put some of the green mix that we have in our store. And just a little bit of stevia to sweeten it up. And it was a really yum. That's the kind of thing you can do for your kids and for yourself in the morning with whey and with colostrum. And it's a nice way to kick the day where you could do a couple scoops and with the colostrum, you know, get up to about 50 grams of protein if you want to go that far just for breakfast. And you get a big glass of that. And I mean, you are good. I don't even think you're going to be thinking about being hungry till about 2 or 3 o'clock, and maybe just have some dinner and you're good to go. So it's kind of a fun way to have really good superfoods in your diet. And you know where the food is coming from, and it's just a beautiful thing. So there's One World Whey, and then you can add the colostrum, and then the seed oils if you like for an extra added attraction, with a little bit of great fat, and you got some good things going. All of these products are available on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. We appreciate your ongoing support.
There are a variety of programs on the One Radio Network, including The Real World of Money on Wednesdays between 9 and 11 Texas time. And it features Andy Goss and our company, SDL Incorporated. For those new listeners to the show, SDL Incorporated provides the best in American gold and silver coins to investors across the United States. If you'd like to become more familiar with the idea of working with American gold and silver coins as part of your investment portfolio, SDL Incorporated has provided some free information to investors and is now making available a set of 3 CDs at your request just by dialing this toll-free number, 1-800-468-2646.
Is that your number, Andrew Goss? I'm curious how that happens. Fred just mentioned your number, and that's you.
Yes.
That's you. You guys been in business for how long?
Gosh, it'll be a week next. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Week for Tuesday, man.
Week next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
Actually, the corporate charter was issued in July of 1981, and I'm the third president of SDL.
The third president?
Yes.
Who was the first two?
Stephen D. Lowenstein, hence the SDL, and John S. Stanziola was number two, and I'm number three.
I see. Uh-huh. But SDL doesn't have G in there.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. You know, we all start at the bottom and work our way up. That's the theme of the company. So
I see.
Who knows who the next president will be? Might be Fred. Uh-huh. He's certainly in line. You know, it could be anyone. Point is, we're a company that's not a one-person thing. You know, we recognize that we're all mortal. Thank you for your efforts. But, you know, someday I'll be gone and the next generation will take over. So SDL is, of course, planning to be here for the long term.
Oh, I see. So that's a good thing for people to know that say, well, you know, what if 30 years from now, Andrew's gone or something like that. Or he's in Belize fishing. You know? Not
right.
just gone, but you know, yeah, he's yeah. just gone. Yeah. He's in Belize fishing and
right.
and you know, and he just, and
well, the next generation led by Mitchell and Seth and Tony, you know, those are the young guys. And so they're up and coming now, and during my tenure they're learning. So there will come a time when the baton gets passed to that next generation, much the way it was when John Stanziola handed it to me. So it is.
So your vision is this
continuation,
SDL, continuation
yes.
of forever. Mm-hmm, that's right. kind of a nice thing.
Well, you have to plan for that if you're serious about your company lasting, and certainly I am.
Uh-huh. And then it's a nice thing to know for the new people in your firm to know that they've got a possibility of a long term lifetime. Thing to take care of their family, and that's right.
If they
cool.
make it so, yeah.
If they make
and
it
you
so.
Know, all of them following the Alexander Hamilton model.
Aren't you guys got
everyone is interested. Mm-hmm. Everyone has an interest in seeing the company succeed, and so then everyone, of course, has an interest in not doing bad things, because Lord knows, uh-huh. You know, I have clients, Patrick, not kidding, that invest big sums of money.
I bet.
And never open the box that I send them. When I call them 10 or 15, 20 years later and say, hey, okay, I need that thing you bought, they actually say they haven't even opened the box.
Really?
Now, yes, really. Now, I'm not suggesting that everyone should not open their boxes, but the point is anything could be in there. Rocks. Open the damn box and take a look. People are very trusting, and I know there are a lot of firms out there that take advantage of that. We try to make sure that folks understand exactly what they're doing and that they cover every base where a possible loss might occur.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Goss, his company, 800-468-2640.
Broadcasting live, weekday morning, this is listener-supported One Radio Network. Broadcasting live, weekday morning, this is listener-supported One Radio Network.
Well, I got to say, Angela Merkel, after visiting with Donald Trump over the weekend and some of the other people with G7, her little pantyhose were just all kind of, she just wasn't having a good day. And she just got back and they started giving speeches. And even her opponent, the Social Democrat guy, Mark Schultz, he accused Mr. Trump, her opponent, right? Angela Merkel's opponent, of destroying Western values and undermining international cooperation. What did Donald Trump say at the G7 that all these people just not happy?
Trade. More trade.
Not even the Paris thing.
Trade.
Forget about the Paris thing. That's almost
secondary.
Really? Just trade. Really?
Trade. Uh-huh. He doesn't think Germany's a fair competitor as it relates to trade. We make it easy for German automobiles to be sold here.
Yeah, we buy a lot of Beamers, man. We buy those Beamers.
They make it difficult for those Caddies to be sold there.
Uh-huh.
So
he doesn't like that. The president doesn't like that.
No, I wouldn't like it either.
I wouldn't either.
I think the new Caddy is just as nice as any Beamer.
Really?
Can we sell it there? No. Yeah, the two-seater that they have.
Cadillac
are
making
it.
Really?
It's an awesome car.
Two-seater?
Yeah.
What do you mean, a Cadillac?
It's like a Cadillac sports car.
I'll be darned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they make nice SUVs, too?
Yes, they do.
Really?
Yeah, those Escalades. That's kind of the choice of security services around the world.
Cadillacs. I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So,
and where are they made?
The U.S. auto industry used to be the dominant role. What's good for GM is good for the country.
Right.
And Cadillac's certainly a GM product. Uh-huh. So there was a time when Detroit was the hub of automobiles all over the world. And through free trade, that position has been lost. So, granted, BMW is making cars in Greer, South Carolina to sell in the United States, and that's perfectly fine with me. And I wish Mercedes would do the same.
And they're nice cars?
They're pretty decent cars, yeah.
Nice car.
Expensive to fix, but...
Yeah, yeah.
Nice cars.
What do you think is the most absolute, most solid running car out there? Do you have any idea?
Lexus.
Really, Lexus?
I hate to say it.
Where are they made?
Japan.
Yeah, they're just they're just really tight. They're
tight, well made, last a long time. I have a RX 300 from 2003.
Yeah.
That has 204,000 miles.
And they just keep on
turning. Never done anything more than brakes.
Yeah.
Exhaust, you know.
Well, I gotta say, you know, that little Prius I have, which is 11 years old now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one set of brakes.
Yeah.
And then the batteries went cattywampus, but you know.
Japanese.
But that was it. I mean, that was it. That's been it.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
so they're well made, these little guys, you know. You gotta
GM was sold into this. Yeah, the engineered well. GM was sold into this bill of goods that, you know, their global operations could expand. You know, they saw themselves as having done everything they could in the U.S. and that they needed the global expansion in order to really fuel their products. And so this idea of free trade makes sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, we'll be able to sell cars in Germany and France and Italy and so forth. But it just, the devil is in the details. It's just not that simple. Barriers to trade, not just in Europe, but in the Far East as well. You know, trying to get those American cars into Japan is just as tough as it is trying to get them into Germany.
Yeah, it's a shame, you know.
Yeah.
No wonder Mr. Trump is just fit to be tied with this stuff.
Yeah.
If people knew all the details, what he knows and he understands.
Sure.
You know, they'd be upset too.
Trade is a big deal.
Yeah,
but that's not my huge deal of the day. My huge deal of the day is the common bond, European common bond we've spoken about for many years.
Okay, let's take this call, and then we'll, you know, and then we're going to talk about the other things and how the United States got Germany on a short leash in the first place. Let's go to the phones here. Good morning. Who's this?
It's John calling from Saudi Arabia.
John, out there, you got any sand for sale?
Oh, we got too much. I'd be happy to sell you some.
Well, good. Yeah, we'd like to buy a truckload, please.
I'll send it to you by FedEx.
Thanks. What's going on, John, in Saudi Arabia?
I just had a question. I was, and I know the whole Patrick and Andy wealth plan, a third of it includes real estate. And I'm right on the fence right now as far as, I know you talked about REITs and rental property. I'm sitting on the fence right now, and I'm wondering what I should be asking myself to help make a decision on which way to go.
Yeah, where do you like to go on vacation?
Home.
Uh-huh. And you go home on vacation, John?
Yes.
And any particular area of the country that you like to call home?
Midwest.
Midwest. So is there any prominent resort property in the Midwest that you can identify? I know the Lake Ozark, Lake of the Ozarks.
Lake of the Ozarks is cool.
Things, it's kind of the Midwest. Well, the point I'm making here is that vacation home, especially while you're, you know, in a foreign country, can be easily rented to cover the mortgage payments, which will help defer some of your actual costs. And it'll receive favorable treatment tax-wise. So I would look at a second home first, especially if you spend the majority of your time out of the country, rather than your permanent home, your resort home, your place where you might go to relax and unwind. And that very same property would, of course, be very attractive to anyone else who wants to relax and unwind. And your ability to rent it to them, thanks to this wonderful internet, has just been so much easier with the various Home Away, I think, is one, and Vacation Rental by Owner and so forth. So it's easier to rent that property without paying 30 to 40% management fees.
Ah, okay. I know as far as, I know you mentioned both, and I know that with REITs, you know, no one's going to call me in the middle of the night with a leaky faucet, but with REITs, I can't use debt as a blessing either.
No, that's right. That, you know, without the debt, you're counting on the return that the REIT generates to offset the interest.
I guess thinking of it that way, I'm kind of leaning more toward debt as a blessing.
Yeah, that's why a resort property that you can finance 80% of it and deduct the 80% mortgage costs from your individual income tax return, you know, that's what makes a lot of sense to me.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, in a condominium on a lake or something that, again, is easily rented during the tourist season, and then used by you when you come back to the United States, perhaps, that would most certainly fit in with a good investment portfolio. It's the second home, the one that you don't mind renting, not your primary home, until you're ready to live there full time.
Okay. Ah, see, that makes sense. I'm going to definitely do some searching on the internet for that and see if I can find some decent places in the area.
Yeah, exactly. Remember where you used to go when you lived there, and where everyone you knew perhaps went. You know, South Carolina, we know Myrtle Beach, and we know Virginia Beach in Virginia, and the beaches in Delaware. Mm-hmm. Even the Jersey Shore has attracted a lot of investment money. And my thought is that as foreigners come to the U.S. to buy as well, they look at these resort properties with a greater eye than, say, a traditional neighborhood where folks raise their families and send them to school and go drive to work. You know, that's an entirely different type of an investment. But a condominium, which eliminates a lot of the maintenance costs because you have the common costs that are borne by a regime which takes care of your property, the only thing you really have to worry about is the inside of the walls. And, that's easy enough to rectify if there are any problems there. And then some sort of a rental plan. You can go the route of a property management company, which may eat into your profit, but you can certainly cover your mortgage payments. Any decent resort property, you can cover the majority of your mortgage payments for the year. So it's a good thing to look at. I would urge you to do so.
I'll do that. I've heard people in the Midwest complain about property taxes, but when I took a trip to New York and New Jersey, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, you definitely don't own your property here. You know, in New Jersey, I live right outside of New York City. It's like a 15, 20-minute commute from my house to Midtown Manhattan. And so this neighborhood is in enormous demand from commuters. And they've driven, of course, prices through the atmosphere. And with 1 in 8 people in New Jersey working for the government or some branch of the government, there is a propensity to tax, that's for sure. And the politicians like to talk about they limit the tax increase. Never are they ever reducing taxes or improving spending. Rather, they're limiting the tax increase. So you can count on every year taxes going up. And that's why resort property, in this case the New Jersey Shore, you know, this is something people do in a good, decent economy. They go on vacation and they need a place to stay while they're there. You take advantage of that. I think rental property in New Jersey anywhere else would be an absolute nightmare.
Okay. I was curious about one other thing. I think it was either the last week or maybe the week before. I can't remember. You were mentioning about some coin that you really wanted. You have a hard time finding. I forget the name. I remember I almost fell off the chair when you said it would probably cost him millions.
Oh, that 1870s $3 gold piece, yeah.
Yep.
You mentioned
that, I'm not sure if that's the one you mentioned, that a foundation had.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah, the Harry Bass Foundation, yeah. So the first time that coin sold in my career was in 1981, I believe. Might have been 87. Either way, it was $687,000. And so that seemed like all the money in the world back then. But today I would gladly pay $5 million if I could get my hands on it. But
really?
$5 million? Yeah, and it's probably too cheap. Yeah, that is...
You think the foundation would take your offer?
No way. Mm-mm.
They wouldn't do it.
Not a chance, no. Yeah, the Harry Bass Foundation was set up in perpetuity for the study of numismatics. He loved coins maybe more than I do, and he established this thing and donated, put a huge chunk of money into the endowment. made a museum and everything. And in fact, I could study the coin. I can look at it. I can hold it. I can, you know, do all that, but can't own it. I think it'll be a generation, maybe two, before that coin comes on the market again.
Wow. That's amazing.
I was just curious. I appreciate your advice. You guys do great work.
Okay.
And,
to
the podcast.
Thanks a lot, John.
Yeah, you know, that coin is unique as far as we know. It's unique as far as we know. Another one has not appeared. But there are plenty of coins in which there are only two or three coins. And those, believe it or not, I mean, when you compare them to a coin like this, they seem incredibly cheap to me. And you can buy coins that are only two or three known, gold coins from the United States Mint, in, you know, the less than a million category. And I don't want to be cavalier about $1 million, but it's just not what it used to be. You know, we're adding, as I mentioned on a previous show, 1,700 new millionaires every single day in the United States.
1,700 a day?
Every single day, 1,700 new millionaires online. And so this is something that I think will continue, the trend towards uniqueness. And the more that you can own something that no one else can own, the more you're allowed to say what it's worth.
Andrew Grouch, you might be thinking about more and more some Texas property here, because I was reading that public pensions currently are $4 trillion underfunded. I mean, that's a lot, $4 trillion.
Yeah, yeah.
Illinois, California, New Jersey
yeah.
will be sure to be the first ones to be taxed more than they are today.
That's right.
To pay for this thing.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
They're gonna come to you guys.
Oh yes.
And say,
pony up.
In what form? There would be state tax.
Yeah,
or property tax.
Municipal property tax. Yeah.
Man.
Because you know, the big thing here in New Jersey is get yourself a political job or a government job. You know, maybe not elected, but appointed.
Why so many government jobs in Jersey? Who would thunk?
Why? You know, because every one of them has a pension, see?
Oh,
and
yeah.
So you can go and be a part-time politician or, you know, a public worker, public servant, and wind up with a pension.
Yeah.
That's just boggles the mind.
Yeah. So these these pension plans are... Defined benefit is certainly a problem from the beginning, right? I don't think there's not a lot of companies that are doing that from the beginning. Nobody does that anymore.
Nobody, right? Where you work 5 years and then you get a guaranteed pension for the rest of your life.
Yeah, how can you do that?
How can you
Only
do
in
that?
The government do they do that.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Because it's a Ponzi scheme.
And
obviously.
Then, of course, you know, back in, I think 1940s, the life expectancy on paper was about, I don't know, 80 or so. And now today, it's 105.
Yeah,
you know, careful. So people are living longer because the whole, I don't know, we just are. People are just figuring it out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all adding to the problem as well, right? And then not as many people are putting in.
Yep.
So, I guess eventually the Fed's going to monetize this money in some fashion or form.
No question.
Yeah,
they'll
create the money. And
they have to.
They have to. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only way out, right?
Which, of course, you know, that's a great segue into the common bond for Europe.
Yeah.
But before the break, we were talking about Germany a little
bit. Yeah, yeah. Thanks for going back to that.
Yeah, Operation Paperclip. I would urge anyone to investigate Operation Paperclip. That's where we effectively snagged like 1,600 of the finest German scientists, engineers, technicians.
Did we now?
Yes, we did, including Wernher von Braun.
Wernher von Braun?
Yeah.
Build this bomb, dude.
Yeah, grabbed them all, brought them to the United States. And we wanted the advantage over the Soviet Union. And so they, of course, did the same thing. They had their Operation Paperclip, in which, you know, they grabbed 2,000. we grabbed 1,600. They grabbed the next 2,000. So, and then Germany was divided into East and West, and we did the currency reform in 1948, which the Soviet Union was adamantly opposed to, and so that sort of set the stage. Then it was the Berlin Wall and the blockade and the air flights in and so forth. This is, the history of the separation or division of Germany between Russia and the United States.
So now Ms. Merkel's out there saying, You know, I just don't know. I just don't know if we can count on these guys anymore. Like, I don't know what we're... Well, I don't know. Just I don't know if we can count on the United States anymore. We just really need to be independent.
Yeah.
What were they counting on us? We've been giving them money. Have they been giving us? Haven't they been paying us money for war reparations?
You're making a joke here, aren't you? I mean, that is
no.
The opposite is true.
So we've been giving them money.
That's right.
Because?
Yeah. Well, because we
clobbered them.
We clobbered them, and then we rebuilt their institutions in our image.
How good for us.
So you know, great book, Science, Technology, and Reparations.
Yeah.
The Exploitation and Plunder of Post-War Germany.
Jeez.
It's a great book. You should check it out.
You actually read that?
Yeah, it's a great little
book. Say that title again.
The Exploitation and Plunder in Post-War Germany. That's the secondary title. The working title, I think, was Science, Technology, and Reparations.
Really? And you read that whole book?
On my bookshelf, yes.
Really? And what does it tell you in that book?
Well, it essentially tells how American corporations were called upon to come into Germany and take over industry and take over finance and take over, and partnerships between former Nazis and U.S. corporations were encouraged, right? Obviously, in Hitler's Germany, major industry was controlled by people who were put in place by the state, right? So in Hitler's regime, they took over corporations and companies by just throwing the owners out and installing their own people. And so then when the Marshall Plan came to be enacted, these very same people were called upon to lead the way in banking, lead the way in manufacturing and so forth, science and technology, and all of it, of course, seeded and funded in the United States. So the Central Bank of Germany and all of the German institutions and the currency reform that was brought about in 1948 and introduced the Deutschmark for the first time.
Deutschmark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This was all Federal Reserve instituted. This is all. So the German post-war experience was largely a replication of the American banking system and a takeover of German industry by American interests. So we never let go of that all through the boom period when Conrad, doggone it. I want to say Wittenauer, but that could be wrong. He was the premier of Germany at the time. And with cooperation from the United States and the leaders of Germany who were installed, this is just a, if you replayed it in Iraq, that's exactly what it would look like. I think somebody.
That's exactly what's going on.
Yeah, there, somebody dusted off the old playbook and said, what did we do then? Let's do the same thing now.
Let's do that here.
Yeah, and so the central bank and all the institutions are all threaded back to the Federal Reserve in New York.
Yeah, and boy, the buzzards are flying over Iraq. Boy, they're...
Aren't they?
Man, the United States have been putting so much money in there. I think they've got, three compounds there now?
Mm-hmm.
Big ones, you know, huge, man.
Yes, indeed.
Man, and I think Mr. Kushner has been over there, and Donald Trump went over there, and... some of the other big boys have been over there.
The Green Zone.
Yeah, the World Bank is in there right now.
Oh, yeah.
Tries trying to get them going, and the IMF's over there. So Iraq is going to be their, they're going to be their Rosetta Stone for the Middle East, right?
Yes.
This is going to be their, the United States are going to operate out of Iraq.
Yeah.
And just keep an eye on their, let me see, national interests. National interests.
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
this is what they're going to do. This is what they're going to do. They're going to try to, I guess, try to pick off Syria and Iran from there.
Yeah.
Phew, man. Boy, what is it? It's amazing. Are the Iranians that bad of people? I don't understand it, how presidents, like even Donald Trump, can come in and all of a sudden they start talking about, like, the Iranians or the devil incarnate, you know, when it was proven that the Saudi Arabia guys were all, the 9/11 guys were from Saudi Arabia, right?
Yeah, 14, I think.
Yeah, from Saudi Arabia. And what is it about Iran that the boys don't like? Is it just another one of these guys that own their own central bank?
Yes and no. You know, a desire.
They just don't like them. They just don't like them.
Well, they can't control them, and that's really
is that what it
an
is?
Issue. Everything was fine until, you know, the Shah of Iran was deposed, and the westernization of Iran stopped, and this more traditional role with government and religion intermixed. Religion is government. You know, it is the law in Iran. So that, of course, was contrary to what we believed. When we had the Shah installed, the westernization of Iran was almost legendary. You know, you go downtown Tehran and you thought you were in a modern, sophisticated eastern United States city. Today, that's definitely not the case. So I don't know if it was the people. But they certainly put in the Ayatollah in short order. They made it clear that they wanted their religion to run their government. And that's what's happened.
Well, it's amazing. As we all know, I guess religion and politics are one and the same in the Middle East, right? It's just a the deal. So how the United States could feel like they could put in this Shah guy, what was it, 56 or?
Yeah, 54, the 55, overthrow of Mogadish.
And put him in there and get away with it without the people just...
Well, that was by the way, that was an open CIA operation,
sure,
well documented.
Of course.
So, talk about meddling in elections.
I mean, that would be like going in and overthrowing de Blasio or something in New York and having
we're
all
hacking
the,
his email.
And making all the ladies wear burkas or something. You know, that's how bizarre that is. You know?
It's just that bizarre.
Jeez, you know. What were these people thinking? I mean, did they?
That they wanted their religion. They, you know, if you can imagine introducing Western morals into the Islamic world,
yeah,
what a shock to those folks it must have been.
And
so, you know, a deeply religious people, they outright rejected it. That they said, no, we won't stand for this corruption.
Is it any wonder that so many of them hate us over there? I mean, they're
what we did in response to that—that's really the. The key, you know, you don't think that the CIA ended its operations with the overthrow and installation of the Shah of Iran. It's not like they stopped. They continued after Khomeini continued. And continued to undermine and engage in covert activities that were not in the best interest of the people of Iran.
Oh, always trying to diss Khomeini.
Yeah.
And which is one... Of course, you know, now I'm putting the pieces together. This Ayatollah Khomeini, what's his name? He was portrayed as like the evilest guy this side of Hitler.
That's right.
In American media and when he was put in, you know, after the revolution. Right. He was like the devil.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Made to look sinister and evil in every caricature and drawing.
Every drawing. Wow. Man. Pretty weird, man. Weird karma how the United States has gotten to this over the last 100 years. I mean, what's...
I hate to say what our payback will be, but who knows, right?
Yeah. Tom writes, in the media appearing to be against Donald Trump does not really mean that they are against Trump. Oh, I feel that is a clever con by the media and think tanks that many people are buying. Do you see any possibility of this?
Yes, I do. I see that the New York Times subscriptions and increased readership and listenership and, you know, it's provided them a coalescence that didn't exist before. So, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post have enjoyed subscription increases because of their coverage of Trump. So is it all about the ratings? Yes. And if the people weren't interested in these Trump stories, would the media continue to print them? That's the real question. So then it's not a conspiracy or a cabal of folks that are saying, report on this, report on this, report on this. But rather, it's a market-driven phenomenon where people are demanding this sort of coverage and these outlets are providing it. So if you go with the latter, it's entertainment, you know, and it's all based on ratings. And the moment people stop watching, they'll stop reporting. I doubt that. Hmm. Not when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, right? And said that he was hiring a team of 20 reporters whose job it was going to be to trash the president, essentially.
Yeah, he said it.
Yeah. So does that sound like some sort of a market-driven thing? Like, okay, I'm going to spend the money. I don't care if the people subscribe or watch or read or not. I'm going to do this. So it's strictly on moral grounds. So, it could be that this is market-driven, but evidence suggests otherwise.
And Jeff is doing pretty good.
Not bad.
Jeff is doing good. Amazon stock went over $1,000 yesterday. I think Jeff has made an extra $19 billion year over year since last year. Pretty good. Pretty good year for Jeff. $19 billion. Jeez.
Yeah, I think it's worth more than all the stores and all the malls
all
put
together. All the
malls
put together, Amazon. Amazon, their stock has split three times since their IPO in 97, and I guess they're due to be split again. I guess when you get up to be 1,000, don't you usually split it again?
Well, tell it to Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah, well, they don't. what's the, explain it to us. What's the theory behind that? I get it where, a guy like Patrick or
it just
Andy
makes
says,
it more attractive
yeah,
to
like,
more
well,
investors.
Yeah, like, well, we can't buy Amazon stock. I mean, I don't even have $500, or much less $1,000.
So we do a 5-to-1 split.
So let's do a 5-to-1 split. So they just split it. Everybody gets more shares.
Yeah.
And then in theory,
the shares are worth less.
And then the shares, and they tend to go up again. And, wow, everybody's happy, especially a guy like Bezos who's got a kabillion shares. Huh?
Right.
That's how you make $19 billion in 1 year.
Yeah. And when I wrote Secret World of Money in 96, Amazon, well, when I released it in 96, Amazon was in its infancy.
Yeah, just starting.
Yeah, and I saw it as a perfect distribution channel. So I made a deal with Amazon, and they sold my first book.
Really?
And yeah, and it was the bestseller on money and finance in 1997, number one bestseller on Amazon. But at the time, it was in its infancy, it's not a big statement. But that was my first exposure to what Amazon.com could do. Mm-hmm. And I'm not at all surprised at the company it's become, and it's going to get even bigger.
Oh yeah.
So,
I mean, he's getting into everything.
He
right?
named
cars,
that company right.
Yeah, Amazon. He's getting into cars. He's getting into movies, of course. Now they're doing video. They're doing production.
Wow. And there's going to be some losers in there, no question about it. But I think overall, Amazon will probably do fine. Yeah. Let's talk about the common bond.
The common bond.
Yes.
Is that what is the common bond?
Well, the common bond is what has been keeping the European community disparate. So we've talked about it at length in prior shows, that in the U.S. we have a treasury bond upon which our entire financial system is based.
Everything.
Right?
Yes.
So it's a single issue, single component.
Treasury says, I owe you $1 million,
and
you buy
that.
A bond. You buy a bond.
That's right.
Treasury
and then
bond.
That treasury bond is all 50 states combined and a single common unified bond.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have that in Europe.
Nope.
What they have is each country issues its own bond.
Yeah, Greeks bonds, European bonds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a result, then Greek bonds, who wants those? But German bonds, everybody wants those.
The Bunds. The Bunds.
That's right.
We got like a Bund.
And so it's very difficult for an entity like the European Central Bank to control finances because, you've got all these disparate bonds. You've got the Greek ones that are worth more than less than the German ones and everything in between.
Yeah.
And so for years now, they've tried this idea of a common unified bond. And man, the resistance was legendary. No one.
From individual companies or
individual
the buyers,
countries,
potential buyers?
Yeah, because Germany didn't want to be thrown into a pool with Greece.
Yeah, who wants that?
Right. They like their own, highly rated credit. But of course.
Yes. And we're Germans today. Oh, we know we are. Yeah.
So yesterday, they announced a mortgage, a sovereign bond-backed security is being developed. And it is where they're going to bundle. Tell me if this sounds familiar.
Oh, we're not going to bundle?
we're going to bundle.
Oh, we love bundles.
Yes, we're going to make a bundle of all the bonds from all the countries.
Really?
And then we're going to divide them into risk tranches. And
see The Big Short. Watch that too.
Yes. Any of this sounding familiar? It should. And so this first time ever, integration, financial integration within the European common market. So this could cause major upheaval, as Hank Paulson famously said, when the tide recedes, you can see who's not wearing a bathing suit. And so this bundling of these bonds could very well trigger an economic event of disastrous proportions in Europe. And who knows who's going to, how this unwind is.
Why just bundling could cause a problem?
Well, yeah, because the scrutiny that's required to put the bond in the bundle is going to be enormous, you can, of course, imagine. And the thought is that by having the low-quality bonds in the bundle, you actually create demand for Greek bonds, which there isn't any right now.
Like you say, where have we heard this before?
Yes.
With the
subprime and prime
mortgages
and
all right now. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it's not, I don't think it's going to end well.
And they're going to call this?
Well, they call it a sovereign-backed security.
Ooh. And so will the individual companies continue to do their own?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, they're going to continue to do their own corporate bond.
But here we're talking about the sovereigns.
You can still buy a Bund or something.
Yeah.
Or Greek bonds if you're if you're on Coke.
But why would you? You could buy whichever risk tranche in this sovereign-backed security meets your needs. So if you need a higher rate of return, then you buy the riskiest part of the bundle. Maybe that's mostly Greek and Italian bonds.
Uh-huh.
And if you want the safest part of the asset, well, then, you know, you buy the what is essentially represents the German bonds. But the point is that there's a risk tranche for every financial appetite. So if you're looking for high risk, you buy the riskiest portion. If you're looking for low risk, you buy the safest portion. And it's not identified in advance, hence the backing. And as typical as what happened in the mortgage-backed security fiasco, they're going to gather up $1 million in face value bonds and bundle them in such a way that they'll now be worth $2 million.
Hmm.
And the extra million will all represent commissions for the banks that bundle and syndicate these offerings. So this is going to be huge. You're talking about $10 trillion
in shadow banking kind of thing.
Yes,
wow.
That's right.
Yeah.
And here's a nice new security for them to
launder
up.
Yeah, man, buy that.
Yeah.
I watched a bit about...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
One more thing to add.
Go ahead.
Is it if you look at the German base against their bonds, and it's the same as the U.S. base, we have about 3 or 4% of GDP in our gold reserves. Germany also has, in that range, 3 to 4% of GDP in their gold reserves. China has 0.7% of their GDP in gold reserves. Just to get to the point.
I thought China had all the gold.
Yeah, no. No, they do not.
Huh.
Relative to their gross domestic product. Remember, they're the second largest economy in the world.
Yeah, they've got a huge GDP.
But in gold holdings, they're way down the list.
Okay. I mean,
Germany's ahead of them. France is ahead of them. Everyone is ahead of the Chinese. And they need to play catch-up ball, especially if the intent of getting them into the SDR was to make the Chinese yuan more of a reserve currency, which that was their goal. In order to really be up there with the big boys, they need to beef up their gold reserves. And they're doing it and have been doing it, but they cannot do it at a fast enough pace. And that therein lies the rub. So I think Jim Rickards wrote a great op-ed piece called The Golden Conspiracy. And I've heard a lot about it. I should probably read it at some point, but I know what point he's making, is that the cooperation among the traders of the world, the central banks primarily, to allow the Chinese time to catch up has resulted in a suppression of gold prices, and that's Mr. Rickard's argument.
I see. So, but the Chinese, they don't have debt.
Say what?
Well, I mean, they don't have sovereign debt.
They most certainly do.
Well, but they own their own central bank.
Yeah. So the point is that the debt is easily absorbed, but it's still sovereign debt. Not that it's going to be included in this European bond, no question.
But other than that, China's really, man, I don't understand most of it, but they're not in very good shape, are they?
No, they were selling off their dollar reserves last year just to pay the bills.
Yeah. Fitch just came out and they say that we're not really happy about everything that's going on in China. They have about, I don't know how much in the shadow banking debt.
$10 trillion. $10 trillion.
One of the biggest.
And it's hidden. It's all black.
It's all dark.
Yeah, it's all black. You can't see it. Which, of course, brings us to another point. Depositary Trust Corporation is. So all of these derivatives transactions that are off the books are dark because nobody can see them.
Yeah.
Well, the Depository Trust Corporation has come up with this great new technology based on blockchains. So they're going to rebuild their credit derivatives clearing platform using a distributed ledger, a blockchain, so that you can see who's covering whom, as it were. You know, how... Because this is the interlocking problem, especially in China, where Corporation A cosigns for Corporation B. And you remember that plan of yours and mine, I owe you $1 billion.
Right.
I write it on a paper bag. I hand it to you. You write, I owe you $1 billion on a paper bag and hand it to me. And guess what? We're both billionaires now.
Yeah, we're billionaires.
I write on my books, I have $1 billion asset. You write on your books, you have $1 billion asset. And in a cash-based accounting system, we don't even have to talk about the part where the other party owes $1 billion. So it's a wonderful way to expand the money supply in a black or dark pool. And that's exactly what has happened, not just in China, but around the world. So as the Depository Trust Corporation starts issuing these, and they do $10 trillion every day in collateralized debt securities. So if all of them are tied to a blockchain and you can see what the collateral is for the security, that eliminates a lot of that darkness and it makes everything transparent. And I think the shock of registering all of these derivatives is going to really drive that total derivatives market to a much higher level than anyone would assume that it's at.
Mm-hmm. Tech giant Baidu has just been Baidu has just been placed on negative watch by Fitch, increased risk of default.
Sure,
it's like the hugest, biggest tech giant. In China.
It'll be like the Madoff thing.
Yeah,
it'd
be
that's
like
the Google of China.
Wow,
yes.
Man.
Yeah, Baidu, and they finance and fund everything. So if they go bad, everything goes bad. It's a horrible, horrible situation in China. And unfortunately, being such a global economy that anything that happens in China will bleed through here at home.
Now, it says that China has nearly 30 trillion yuan outstanding in wealth management products. What are WMPs?
Yeah, I owe you.
I owe
you. You've got your money on deposit.
So it's one of those Andy and Patrick things?
Yeah, well, it's...
a billionaire?
It could be, but it is, mom and pop Chinese deposit their money in a long-term retirement account that banks and other entities are supposed to manage. And the argument is that they've done a very poor job of managing. And in fact, all of these liabilities, which is what they are, right? You owe all of these individual Chinese folks this money, are mismanaged, mishandled, and that if they were called upon tomorrow to pay it all over, it would bust out the majority of Chinese companies. So their insurance companies would go broke, their banks would probably go broke. In fact, there's some banking defaults brewing right now related to the Chinese circumstance.
I don't get it. You know, the image out there is these young Chinese kids find their way over here, and they're just smart as a whip, right? I mean, they know math, you know, they're just computer. So don't these guys in China have computers and look at balance sheets and figure this stuff out? Or they just kind of caught the Western model of who cares?
Well, crunch all you want,
crunch
we'll
all
make
you want,
more.
We'll make more kind of thing.
Yeah.
They just kind of got, somehow they drank the Kool-Aid.
Well, there's no running out.
Yeah, they drank the Western Kool-Aid 20, 30 years ago.
Right? We're not going to run out of zeros.
So what does it matter?
What's the problem? There is no problem.
But the thing of it is, when you got 1.6 billion people or something, and you know, you get a tiger by the tail, and boy, if China really starts to do dumb things, I mean, man, who knows what's in it for people using dollars, I guess. Actually, though, if the yuan goes down, who cares? What do we care, right?
Yeah.
The yuan goes down in value?
Yeah, what do we care? Except we lose what little competitive advantage we have left.
Yeah.
So
that's
our
true.
Choice will be to, okay, we got to devalue the dollar.
Yeah.
So, the biggest bank in Azerbaijan is the crash, right? The International Bank of Azerbaijan missed a bond payment 2 weeks before its maturity. So they're unable to pay and told people they're unable to pay. So if everyone runs at the same time from this bank and it's interconnected to another bank, which it no doubt is, then you could see a banking crisis originate in the former Soviet Union, Azerbaijan, and spread its way into Europe and eventually around the world.
So how do we short China?
Yeah. How do you short China? How do you get paid if you're right? That's really, you know, it's like you could have bought AIG coverage for, you know, defaulted mortgage-backed securities, but getting paid, that's the issue.
Yeah, that's the issue.
So, yeah, you might be able to short China. There's probably an index that allows you to do just that.
Really? Just short the whole country?
Yeah.
Or they probably have an index saying China's going to go boom if it goes up. You know, it's an ETF or something.
Yeah, it's an ETF that like we have the FANGs, right? The Facebook, Apple.
We got FANGs?
Yeah.
You got FANG ETF?
Netflix and Google.
Oh, so you could just... Yeah, you would short them if you really
short that. Short that whole. Right. Short their index of the top 10 or 20 Chinese industrial or financial companies.
Oh, I see. Let's short them little babies.